This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the West Asia region is tense after Israel has initiated air raids against Lebanon, and the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah has responded by firing a barrage of rockets back at the regime in the occupied Sheba farms. Now, the equation in the region has transitioned as Israeli aggression is immediately met by the resistance, which responds accordingly. Another significant variable this time around seems to be the unity of the resistance front against the Zionist regime. We'll be looking at all of this on The Spotlight. First of all, I'd like to start off in Beirut with Press TV's Mariam Saleh. Mariam, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the situation, of course, even as we're talking right now. Said Hassan Nasrallah is finishing his speech, but tell us about the significance, some of the points that he made about what has happened.
Yes, of course, he gave very significant points when it comes to the issue of retaliating and confronting Israel. He stressed, of course, the fact that we do have a new regional equation, which would, of course, lead to a solidarity between all of the resistance groups. But he has spoken about this extensively before. Today, he focused a little bit more on exactly what happened on the Israeli shelling of areas. And this is the first time in 15 years that we have a shelling from the Air Force, from the Israeli military Air Force. And that is why he said that Hezbollah was quick to respond, quick to make sure to take things back to the deterrence equation that was sustained since the end of the 2006 war, which lasted for 33 days. As you know, now we are commemorating that event. It began in July and ended in August. So therefore, Sayyid Nasrallah also explained why Hezbollah was quick to respond, why he has not retaliated, for example, for the martyrdom of certain fighters that were killed, whether in Syria or on the border with Lebanon during protests in solidarity with Al-Quds, the Sword of Al-Quds. He said that this is only to stress the fact and tell the Israelis that it is forbidden to launch the shelling from your air force, even if it is on open territory. As you know, the Israelis launched on Thursday some shelling in open territory. Therefore, as Hezbollah was quick to respond, also on open territory in the occupied Sheba farms. But he also stressed that next time it will not be only in the Sheba farms. It could even be in targets in occupied Palestine or in the occupied Golan Heights.
And I thought it was interesting, Mariam, one point that also he made was that the resistance initiated that attack during the day because they didn't want to initiate terror against civilians. The opposite, of course, of what the Israeli regime did and, of course, initiated those attacks on Lebanon in the middle of the night. Thanks so much for that update out of Beirut. That's Mariam Saleh. And now I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Another guest, author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York. And historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Halset. Thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off in New York with Jim. Your take, Jim, why do you think that Israel initiated this attack on Lebanon now?
I'm not sure. You know, as your correspondent said, it seems to have been an attack on an open area, which, you know, doesn't seem to have much rationale to it. The response by Hezbollah also was an open area. I think they were trying to provoke Hezbollah into a response. Hezbollah did, this is the first time in 15 years, they've claimed a rocket attack against Israel. And they made very clear, we deliberately put it into the into an open area, et cetera. And I think really what you have is Israel is dying to get into war with Lebanon, with Iran. And they're trying to provoke something, I think. So generally speaking, I think that would be, you know, their stance after the supposed missile attack or the drone attack on the ship in the Gulf was we have to go to war with Iran. And they're trying to get the Americans to go along with that. So I think they're hoping to provoke something that would be a casus belli, that they could present as a casus belli to the world.
Brett, your thoughts on that. Do you think that Israel wants to go to war on Lebanon?
Well, I think this is definitely a strong possibility. We have to bear in mind that Israel itself is coming out of years of political strife and internal struggle within the Zionist entity itself. When you read mainstream media in the West, they often like to talk about the fact that Lebanon is mired in political strife and infighting on the political level. But the same goes, of course, for the Zionist entity itself. They have had several elections in the span of just a couple of years, and eventually they had to find a form of unity government in order to get Benjamin Netanyahu out, a unity government with eight parties that have a very fragile balance right now, which has seen Naftali Bennett come to power, but on a very fragile and very shaky ground that he is standing on. And in fact, the issues that have been plaguing the Zionist entity have been so big that in many cases during these elections, they didn't even talk about what to do with Palestine, what to do with the resistance, because they were too busy talking about the internal actual struggles that plagued the people over there. So from that point of view, it is very important, I think, for a Zionist politician, especially an aggressive hawkish politician such as Naftali Bennett, to try to lure all the attention away from the internal problems and struggles of his colonial regime and instead focus the attention on a potential foreign war that he's probably hoping to bring to a swift and successful conclusion. This is playing by the book that has been going along for hundreds and hundreds of years, of course, especially in imperial politics, is whenever you have internal domestic struggle, try to find an external enemy and go to war. The United States has been doing that for nearly 300 years now, and it has at times really worked in order to save politicians' political career. And this is something that I think Naftali Bennett is trying now as well. Mm-hmm. Added to that, of course, there might be something to it that it's the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war in which Lebanon, led by Hezbollah, of course, dealt a sound defeat against the Zionist forces. And they are now, of course, celebrating this. So what better time to try to lure Lebanon into another war from the Zionist point of view than during this 15th anniversary? This might also be somewhat of a symbolic gesture on their behalf.
Okay. Well, Jim, what about that, what Brett said? Because if that's the case... he talked about in basically uniting the people at home with a foreign war. But the other side of that would be Hezbollah is not an easy target, obviously. Tel Aviv saw that in 2006. And now if we fast forward 15 years later, Hezbollah has had a tremendous amount of experience now in dealing with Syria and elsewhere. Do you agree that Tel Aviv is willing to risk whatever it has to take on Hezbollah and its allies?
I think they're in a quandary about that. Yes, you're absolutely right. Hezbollah, they perceive Hezbollah as a threat now because they're afraid that Hezbollah has precision missiles, and they very well might, and they have a lot of missiles anyway, and they know they have missiles that can hit anywhere in Israel, and it's quite clear that if there's an attack on Iran or Lebanon, Hezbollah is going to launch missiles that will strike the heart of Israel. And Israel doesn't, they really don't know what to do about it, because on the one hand, they're watching them get stronger, so they think we have to do something, we have to go out and attack them, but they also know if they do, they might get hit very strongly. And that's why there was a little dance here where the Israelis themselves kind of pulled back at the end and said, okay, you know, we're going to accept this, we're not going to go any further. But what they want to do is they want to find out what the capabilities of Hezbollah are. And they want to destroy Lebanon. They want to try and get rid of Hezbollah with financial crisis and with economic siege, which is what they're doing. You know, all this business about we've got to reform Lebanon. Lebanese politics do have to be reformed. But what the Israelis and the Americans mean by that is you've got to get rid of Hezbollah. So they're trying on all fronts to get rid of Hezbollah, to weaken Hezbollah. But they're also, and they have been for years, trying to get the United States to agree with them to attack Iran. Now, and that's why they keep saying that. So this is really part of a strategy that's difficult for the Israelis to negotiate, because they're already at the point where they're going to be hit hard. You know, and as one Iranian commander had said at some point, you know, when missiles start raining down in Tel Aviv, you're going to see a lot of people going back to Brooklyn. And so this is something that the Israelis can't take, but they can't just sit back and they feel like we can't just sit back and watch Iran and Hezbollah get stronger, because we want to be in the position where we can do militarily whatever we want to any country in the region that we want. We can bomb Syria every day. We can blow up Iranian tankers in the Gulf, you know, but they can't do anything to us. And Hezbollah is saying to a certain extent with this, look, we're willing to attack you. We're not going to be shy about saying we sent these rockets. So Israel has to figure out what to do about that. And It's a quandary for Israel.
What about, Brett, the difference between Hezbollah of 2006 and Hezbollah of 2021?
There is the difference between the two is, in such a way, in terms of military capabilities, that it would be the capacities of Hezbollah right now in terms of military and political strength would be almost inconceivable, I think, to an onlooker back in 2006. There have been studies done into the military power, or at least estimates into the military power of Hezbollah, that say that the Hezbollah rocket and missile capacity is on par with that of an average NATO member state, of course, not taking into consideration the military powerhouse of the United States itself. So this is Hezbollah is by itself has a military strength of a small country. They have the support of an actual country, the majority of an actual country, of Lebanon, of the Lebanese people. They have support across sectarian lines, across ethnic lines, across religious differences, as a almost universally respected member and leader locally of the resistance against Zionism. So this power that Hezbollah has been showcasing, I think, and has been building up the past 15 years, is of such an extent that I think that even the Israelis themselves have massively underestimated this. Indeed, I agree with the other guest. Indeed, what has been said is they're sort of somewhat testing the waters, and they're seeing how strong exactly Lebanon is. But I think we have seen by the fact that the Israelis, they attack Lebanon, but they make sure to attack in an empty spot first to see what the reaction will be. I think they are, at the same time, they want to be hawkish, they want to be aggressive, but at the same time, they are scared, because I think deep down they know that if they wanted to take on Hezbollah one-on-one again, like they tried and failed in 2006, they should have done this like 10 years ago. They shouldn't have waited this long. And because what happened in the meantime, of course, Shahid Qasem Soleimani happened, the resistance in Syria happened, the massive Iranian support build-up for the resistance in Lebanon and in Syria itself happened all in the past couple of years and has massively bolstered the resistance units in Lebanon itself and across the entire region. So the Israelis are really starting to come to terms, I think. The military strategists, they know deep down, of course they won't say it, but they know deep down that the prowess of on the military battlefield of Hezbollah is of such an extent nowadays that they can't expect to just go in there and fight them in the way that they were hoping to do back in the day, back in 2006. And that is why they are trying to find a new strategy. They are indeed, as has been said, they are trying to destabilize Hezbollah's power base by economically sabotaging Lebanon itself, by spreading misinformation through media and through their minions in Lebanon. But it is something that is, it's shaky at best. The way in which the Israelis are doing it now is at some points nearly amateuristic, because they are so uncertain on what they have to do and how they can take on Hezbollah on the battlefield.
Well, Jim, you talked about the destabilization, the attempt to destabilize Lebanon through economic means and social unrest. And of course, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he addressed this and basically a message to the Israelis, don't try us, even though we have many, many problems, but the defense of Lebanon is the number one priority for the resistance. I want to talk about deterrence and the importance of that. If we see from 2006 until now that the Israelis hadn't attacked, do you think the tactics used by Hezbollah will continue to protect the country or not?
Well, I think that, you know, Hezbollah, as previous guest and I have said, you know, has built up its military capacity in such a way that it feels comfortable that it can reasonably protect the country and do damage, serious damage, and win perhaps and probably a military struggle against Israel. But these economic attacks are something else that are hard to counter in the way that, because the United States controls so much of the financial institutions of the world and the financial power of the world, that you can create a financial crisis, you can create an economic crisis, you know, you can make it difficult to buy things on the international market, you can create shortages of electricity and meat, et cetera. And this is the attempt that the United States makes throughout the world in regimes it wants to change to create suffering among the people that they can blame on the regime. Now, in this case, you have the Americans and Israel trying to construct a narrative in which the problem is Hezbollah, okay? And, you know, that's going to resonate with some people in the sense that, you know, if there are people who don't care too much about the Palestinians in Lebanon, and there probably are some, you know, they're going to say, why should we be buffeted by this because the Hezbollah is there, you know, as a military threat to Israel. But I think that, as we've been saying, in general in the last few years, the unity of the resistance on behalf of the Palestinians has strengthened. So I don't think it's going to work. I mean, we have to be humble and aware of the fact that this is a lot of economic power the United States has, and they're using it, and it can cause disruptions and disunity. That's what they want to do. They want to divide people, and they want them to blame Hezbollah for the problems they're having.
Well, Brett, I want to look at another angle of this, because this time around, there's growing solidarity among the resistance and its support for Hezbollah, from the Palestinian resistance movements to Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Iran. They've all announced their solidarity and support of Hezbollah in fighting Israel. Your thoughts on this, the significance of this change this time around?
I think this is one of the most important developments that we have seen internationally speaking, and especially for West Asia in the past decade, basically, in the 21st century so far, is the development of a multipolar world order that has been spreading, has been developing all across the world, of course, with new superpowers and regional powers rising up and claiming their national sovereignty and their right to decide their own, to take their own matters into their own hands, away from the dictates of the United States and their allies. And this is, in the Islamic world in particular, this, of course, has been materializing in the Mukawama, in the Islamic resistance that has been spreading across the Middle East, across Western Asia, and which often in the Western propaganda is called somewhat of a Shia crescent, even though it's in order to portray it as in a sectarian point, of course, in order, because that is as well, of course, is part of the propaganda mill in order to try to sow sectarian dissent and strife amongst the Muslim people. What we have seen in the past 20 years and what has scared the Western powers and the Zionists to such a massive degree is exactly that cooperation that we have seen between the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Syrian Arab Republic, the people of Lebanon, especially in Hezbollah. We have seen in Iraq, of course, ever since the conflict against Daesh, this has come to the forefront, the Hashd al-Sha'abi, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and other movements in Iraq who have been allying with this international movement of resistance against imperialism. And now, of course, in 2014, also the people of Yemen. This is something that has shown itself to be an extremely powerful strategy. And it shows the strength of solidarity across sectarian lines, across religious divides, across ethnic divides, against this war against Western Asia that has been going on for at least the past 100 years, ever since Sykes-Picot, the agreement between Sykes and Picot and the British and the French redistribution of Western Asian land between themselves, and of course since the Balfour Declaration, in which they agreed, the Western powers agreed to basically steal Palestinian land and give it to the Zionists. This is a constant war against the people of Western Asia and against the spirit of Islam itself that has been going on since the end of World War I at the very least. And this is something that has been, this conflict has been waged with the West gradually, like generally winning over and over again for the most part up until the last couple of decades, when now the West has been defeated bit by bit in small battles at first, but bit by bit, gradually but steadily, they have been losing influence, and they have been losing to a variety of countries, a variety of political movements, a variety of religious groups, but who are all united together under the banner of anti-imperialism and the defense of the national sovereignty and of their national self-determination. And this is the most important thing that that is going on there right now, and that is exactly why Iran is one of the most important blame factors in Western propaganda. Next to, of course, on a worldwide level, you have they blame things on Russia, they blame things on China, but everything related to the Middle East and to Western Asia in general, to the Arab world, will always be blamed on Iran. The war in Syria was blamed on Iran, the war in Yemen is being blamed on Iran, and the reason for that being that Iran is seen, and rightfully so, I think, as some sort of a regional power and a regional hub of resistance. They have been uniting the powers of the forces of resistance, which we have seen beautifully during the inauguration of President Ibrahim Raisi, when people from all over the Islamic world came to Tehran in order to pay their respects and in order to basically congratulate the president on his election. This is a showcase of that global unity and that regional unity and collaboration, cooperation, and solidarity that has been growing in the area for the past 20 years.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of this spotlight. I appreciate both of you being with me. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasset. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for staying with us.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we'll riff you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Until when we seize their affluent ones with punishment, at once they are crying to Allah for help. Do not cry out today. Indeed, by us you will not be helped. My verses had already been recited to you, but you were turning back on your heels.
Brothers and sisters, in this program, we will inshallah talk about the 64th and 65th verses of this chapter, and we will move on to the next verses. In the previous program, we started talking about the 64th verse, حَتَّى إِذَا أَخَذْنَا مُتْرَفِيهِمْ بِالْعَذَابِ إِذَا هُمْ يَجْأَرُونَ. Until when we seize the luxurious ones of them with punishment, behold, they groan. We talked about the reason why they start groaning and somehow howling like the wolves or the dogs. The next verse says that it will be said to them, لَا تَجْأَرُوا الْيَوْمِ, groan not this day. إِنَّكُمْ مِنَّا لَا تُنْصَرُوا. Surely, you will not be helped by us. So the wrongdoers are not limited to those mutrafin, those who receive the good things of this world. They are called mutrafin either because they are the chiefs and leaders of the ignorance and deviation, or because their punishment will be more painful and severe. And the punishment mentioned here may be the punishment in this world, or in hereafter, or maybe both. And when Allah punishes them in this world or in hereafter, they will cry loudly and supplicate. But at that time, the dice has already been cast and the chastisement has been decided. They will not be able to return, and neither there will be any help for them on that day. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding this verse says, Allah the Exalted has sworn that three groups have no place in paradise. The group that rejects the commandments of the Almighty Allah, the group that does not obey the command of the leading Imam, and the group that does not give a believer his due. So the day of resurrection is not the day of begging and asking the Almighty. That is the day of punishment, the day of chastisement for the wrongdoers, and the day of salvation for the righteous. And those wrongdoers, since they did not give their wealth in charity in this world, they will not be helped in hereafter. إِنَّكُمْ مِنَّا لَتُنْصَرُونَ. This is one reason.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
بدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
But the 66th verse also talks about another aspect of why they will not be helped on that day. The verse says, قَدْ كَانَتْ آيَاتِي تُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ فَكُنْتُمْ عَلَىٰ أَعْقَابِكُمْ تَنْكِصُونَ. Indeed, my signs used to be rehearsed to you, but you used to turn back on your heels. So this verse, as mentioned earlier, actually tells us the primary cause of their fate. It indicates that in former times, Almighty Allah's signs used to be rehearsed to them, but they used to turn back their heels. They used to turn their backs to the signs of the Almighty Allah, instead of learning a lesson from those signs, instead of changing their paths. The Quranic word tenkisun here, to turn back on one's heel, is derived from the word nekas, and it means to regress or retreat. The Arabic word aqab is the plural form of aqib, and it means the heel of the foot. The whole sentence means that when people hear something that is in contrast to what they already believe, or they do not want to believe it, they get so disturbed that they turn back on their heels and go back in retreat. And this kind of retreat, turning on their backs to something, is not for the signs of the Almighty Allah. The next verse is telling us that not only do they turn back by hearing the verses of the Almighty Allah, but they also maintained an arrogant and dismissive attitude towards the object of their revulsion as well. So they used to hold their nightly gatherings and vilify the Prophet ﷺ, not just him, but also the Quran and the believers. We will, inshallah, talk about this verse more in the next program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things goodbye. Always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinian groups in the Gaza Strip hailed the Hezbollah's move to fire a parade of rockets toward the Israeli regime in response to Thursday Israeli air raids on South Lebanon. Palestinians welcomed the move, describing it as a strong message to Israel.
The Lebanese rockets foiled Israeli plans and projects aimed at separating the resistance in the region. It proved that the resistance won't remain silent in the face of the Israeli crimes. The Lebanese response is a message that Israel cannot impose its policies in the region, and the resistance will keep defending its rights.
The Israeli military said its Iron Dome system intercepted 10 of 19 rockets on Friday, with six falling in open areas in a third day of tension across the borders. There have been no reports of casualties or serious damage. Palestinian groups expressed their support to all forms of resistance against Israel and announced their readiness to stand with the resistance movement in Lebanon in defending their rights.
We hail the response of the resistance in Lebanon against Israeli airstrikes. This Lebanese move emphasizes the importance of the resistance in defending its rights and foiling the Israeli policies. The Israeli regime is also still practicing all forms of violence against the Islamic and Arab nations, and the resistance is the only way to put an end to these crimes.
The resistance said it won't allow the Israeli regime to impose new policies in the region and that Israel won't go unpunished for its crimes.
We really welcome the Lebanese move to respond to the Israeli airstrikes in South Lebanon and fire rockets at the occupied territories. We stress that we are all united in resistance to liberating Palestine and getting the Israeli occupation away from the region. We are supporting our brothers in Lebanon, and we are all ready to defend any Israeli aggression against Lebanon.
Palestinian factions here welcome the Lebanese response against the Israeli attacks, stressing on fully supporting the resistance in Lebanon against the Israeli aggression with all means. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabah farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasim stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely high state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006. Whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land, or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. with no civilian areas targeted from both sides, the status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Following a recent call by the Afghan president on the entire nation to establish a united national front against the Taliban, residents of many cities, including Kabul, have welcomed the call by different moves, such as taking to the streets to chant supportive slogans and joining local armed fronts across the country.
Rural people of Afghanistan widely welcome President Ghani's call for the establishment of a national front against the Taliban. We saw how rural people in Herat and other cities put their unity on show by chanting slogans in support of Afghan military forces. This shows that it is a real national uprising.
The entire nation knows that the Taliban have ruined the infrastructures. They are just after war and violence. So I strongly support Afghan national security and defense forces to stand against Taliban.
Afghan military forces say they are committed to strongly pound terrorists all over Afghanistan, mainly in southern Helmand province, thanks to strong support they are receiving from locals.
A report suggests that the shadow governor of Taliban for Helmand province and a number of top military commanders, plus hundreds of them, have so far been killed in attacks conducted by our forces. We will strongly pound anyone who stands against the nation, against the republic and the constitution. The Taliban must realize that we are committed to defend our land.
Referring to the recent war crimes committed by Taliban, locals here say, unlike the beliefs of U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad, who had said that Taliban has changed, the recent advances of Taliban proved that they are still following a dogmatic ideology. Some of the displaced Afghans accused Taliban militants of committing war crimes during their assaults on districts and provincial capitals over the recent month. They say the Taliban have killed civilians, used them as human shields, and destroyed their houses. The only way against the militants' violence, they say, is to resist. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Britain is known to be the hub of terrorist and corrupt fugitive political leaders fled from Pakistan. This is London residence of Altaf Hussain, a leader of Karachi-based ethnic political party. Back home, Hussain was convicted on terrorism and murder charges. Nonetheless, UK never handed him back to Pakistan of being what many believe an intelligence asset of British secret services. This is Ishaq Dar, the former finance minister who fled from Pakistan in 2018 to avoid prosecution on money laundering charges. And here comes the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who has been staying in these luxurious flats, which judges back in Pakistan found were purchased with the looted public money. However, pressure from Islamabad has now compelled Britain to change its long-held pro-fugitive policy after London decided to expel Nawaz Sharif. His request to further stay in the UK was rejected by Britain. His Pakistani passport is already invalid after Islamabad refused to renew it.
The UK government has been under intense pressure, not only from Pakistan, but various other countries whose fugitive leaders have been living in UK for a long period of time. UK government was under great pressure and under great criticism. And that could be a reason that the UK government basically did not allow Nawaz Sharif to stay on or extend the visa of Nawaz Sharif to stay in UK.
Nawaz Sharif fled Pakistan after plundering public exchequer. He should now come back to Pakistan and must return the money he looted, and after this he can comfortably stay at his home in Pakistan.
Sharif was convicted and sentenced for 10 years on money laundering charges, but was released from jail in November 2019 only for medical treatment for a few weeks. However, since then he has been residing in London despite repeated court orders to return home to face trial of corruption cases. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is fast running out of his legal and political options after Britain decided to expel him. One of the choices, analysts believe, is to seek shelter in an Arab country after exhausting his all legal options to delay his expulsion from the UK. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Pakistan's president, foreign minister, and others joined this rally in support of the people of Kashmir. The rallies were held in Pakistan to mark the second anniversary of India's, what Pakistan says, illegal move to revoke the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. India, on August 5, 2019, abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that granted special status to the Jammu and Kashmir region. Pakistan rejected the move as a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions that seek a referendum to decide the final status of Jammu and Kashmir.
I want to assure my Kashmiri brothers that Pakistan will continue to support the people of Kashmir for their right to self-determination. We will continue to support Kashmiris till they get freedom.
Go India, go back!
Separately, Kashmiri leaders also took to the streets in Islamabad. The All Parties Hurriyat Conference staged a protest not far from the Indian High Commission in Islamabad.
We, the Kashmiris, not only in occupied Kashmir, Azad Kashmir, or in Pakistan, but over the world, where the Kashmiris are present, they are making this day as a black day. Why we are making this day as a black day? Because against the will and wish of the people of the Kashmir, India has abrogated its articles.
Protesters condemned the Indian policy towards Kashmir and vowed to continue their struggle until Kashmiris get their right to self-determination.
Kashmir is a disputed territory as per the United Nations resolutions. The resolutions have been passed and at the behest of the India. It was India who took the Kashmir dispute to the United Nations. And it is India, it is the then Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, who in his communique to Pakistan said, we do not believe in forced marriages, and Kashmiris will be given right to self-determination.
Kashmir remains at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan. The dispute dates back to the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Both countries have fought wars over the only Muslim-majority state controlled by India.
Tensions between India and Pakistan have further deepened since India revoked the special status of Kashmir. Pakistan insists India has to reverse the changes for any talks. India, however, is defending the changes, calling it as its internal matter, and hence the deadlock. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The brutal battle between Taliban and government forces has intensified recently, with each side struggling to gain more area under their control. Top military officials in southern Helmand province have urged the residents of the city of Lashkargah to evacuate their houses. Reports say Afghan forces are planning to launch a heavy attack on Taliban inside the city of Lashkargah, who use residences of locals as human shields.
We had announced that if a single Talib arrives in Lashkargah city, he will be killed. Even if 1,000 of them arrive, we will kill them all. This fight is not ours. They are Takfiris and slaves of Punjabis. They aren't Afghans. Our fight against them is a pure jihad, and we will continue this holy jihad with a strong will.
Taliban has in recent weeks launched more attacks on provincial capitals, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. This comes as many here believe neither the government nor the Taliban will achieve their goals to take full control of the country via insisting on further war. They say negotiation is the only solution to resolve the conflicts.
Today, the ancient city of Herat is under attack, and the war has reached inside people's houses in Lashkargah of Helmand. Meanwhile, violence is spreading across the northern Taliban city and other areas. We still hope to reach peace through responsible moves by the government and Taliban.
Based on official figures, over 1,000 Taliban militants have lost their lives in a series of attacks carried out by Afghan air and ground forces backed by local armed fronts since last week. Afghan forces increased their attacks on Taliban militants and liberated some of lost areas, including Nijrab and Tala Obarfak districts in northern and northeastern Afghanistan. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently called on the entire nation to establish a united national resistance front against the Taliban. He argues that since the Taliban have put military victory on the top of its priorities list, the time has come to talk to militants with guns and resistance. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
British Muslim advocacy group CAGE is preparing to go to war with the British government after announcing a legal bid against Education Minister Gavin Williamson over what they call discriminatory guidance to school leaders on Palestine. CAGE say the letter issued by Williamson on May the 28th amounted to a disgraceful censorship of political dissent in schools and discriminated against students by infringing their rights to freedom of expression.
CAGE has seen nearly 50 cases of people, of students, who have been targeted in their schools for speaking openly about Palestine and defending the rights of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against a system of apartheid and oppression and occupation.
The government's crackdown on Palestine solidarity in UK schools occurred during the huge global outrage over Israel's relentless attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and civilians in Gaza last May. Williamson's letter warned teachers to remain impartial on the conflict, but also warned of concerning rise in anti-Semitic incidents. However, CAGE believe this is censorship cloaked by bogus accusations of anti-Semitism.
It is definitely becoming more of the case that speaking on the issue of Palestine, advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, exposing the crimes of the Israeli apartheid regime, these are becoming increasingly issues which are criminalized, issues which are securitized, dealt with very punitive measures, whether in schools, whether in public spaces, or the debate about it is completely hounded out of the public space, such that these issues are silenced and they are unheard.
CAGE are confident of success, as they believe that the government's position on this topic won't hold water if confronted in the courts. And many people are hoping for success here, as the way things are going now, many critics claim and fear that it could become essentially illegal to support the Palestinian cause publicly in the not-too-distant future, unless court battles like this are won now. Robert Carter, London.
Thousands of Lebanese commemorated the first anniversary of the catastrophic explosion which rocked Beirut. Accountability and justice was the main demand of the families of the martyrs.
August 4 should turn into a historic day by holding criminals accountable. The criminals who brought the ammonium nitrate to the port, they killed our children. I lost my only son because of their corruption.
I lost my brother in the blast and lost my mother only 2 months later. She died because of her grief for her son. I want justice for the sake of my brother and my mother. We want justice and we want to see everyone connected with the crime being put on trial.
On August 4th, 2020, a stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was stored without prudence, exploded, becoming one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in modern history, leaving over 200 people killed and thousands injured. The state of mourning for those who fell on the Beirut port explosion is still well alive in the hearts and minds of the Lebanese people, yet justice for the victims still seems out of sight. Yet mourning rallies quickly turned violent after some protesters tried to break into the parliament building. Security forces fired water cannon and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters. Several people were injured. In parallel with the protests, a virtual conference was held in support of Lebanon, where Lebanese President Michel Aoun said the quest for truth and full justice is still the main claim of every Lebanese.
I have already committed before the Lebanese to serve justice and hold accountable everyone whose involvement is proven by the investigation. Today, I restate my pledge that no one is above the law, no matter how high they may rank. Let justice go all the way in probe and trials.
Aoun stressed that the funds given to Lebanon from the International Monetary Fund must be spent in the best way to face the collapse and embark on reforms, one of which is forensic auditing. She highlighted as very significant. This event comes as Lebanese officials are yet to form a cabinet. Demonstrators' anger is not only at the injustice in the Beirut port case, but at the ineffectiveness of the political class in dealing with the crisis. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Ebrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. With Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ebrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said it will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers. Coming from the principal's camp, Ebrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian Parliament in Tehran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadiri, from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Our question today regards the sin of some of the people of hell. And the question is as follows. This questioner, he says that the sin of these people who have gone to hell now in their life on this world was intercourse and drinking alcohol. How is it then that the reward of the believers in heaven is just that, intercourse and, of course, maybe not alcohol, but a type of alcohol-free alcohol? So just wondering. So please enlighten us, dear Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. At the first point, I would like to refer to the fact that sometimes when we talk about the religion of Islam and its approach toward the pleasures, some people, their impression is that Islam is against some worldly pleasures, which is not the case. I mean, it's been mentioned in the Quran, which shows the importance of this topic, that Islam is for the